a couple of housekeeping items, really just one. If you have a cell phone, would you please turn it off so that it doesn't interrupt the proceedings? And also, because we have a number of individuals to testify, a couple things. Keep your remarks very succinct, and I think I'll give 2 minutes for each. If you have written testimony, please hand it. And who's going to take
Jennifer.
It? Jennifer. Jennifer is there, and she will accept your written testimony in order to distribute it to the members. With that, I'm going to call Senator Burdick up because she has to go to another committee right away, and so I may be taking some testimony out of order.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I really appreciate the chance to testify. My name is Jenny Burdick, and I represent Senate District 18. I don't want to take a lot of time because there are people who are sitting in back of me who I would much rather have a chance to speak to you today in the limited time. But I just wanted to add my voice to the many in support of tobacco prevention funding. We made an agreement, a contract with the voters when they approved two cigarette tax increases that we would put a portion of the money into prevention of prevention geared primarily at young people. These programs save lives, they save money, they prevent children from smoking, they help people quit smoking. Studies have shown that people will quit, a certain number of people quit when the price goes up as the taxes do. So, and the prevention programs help that as well. So I just wanted to add my voice to the many voices who are here today and many voices who are not here today in strong support of preventing smoking from starting in the first place and helping people who are unfortunate enough to smoke to quit the habit. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Bruce Piper, Sheila North, Rick Trelevin, and Rita Sullivan. And I understand that, Bruce, you're in charge of coordinating?
Yeah, Bruce couldn't make it.
Oh, okay. Bruce couldn't make
it. Ann Euler.
Oh, Ann Euler's going to be Bruce?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right, Ann.
We can't even see through this one.
Okay. We can switch around here. Good afternoon. My name is Ann Uhler. I'm here representing the ADAPT-PAL, which stands for the Alcohol and Drug Addiction Program Administrators of Oregon. I'm the past president of the association. I am also the representative for the Oregon Treatment Network to the National Institute of Drug Abuse and their Clinical Trials Network. I've recently retired as the executive director of CODA Incorporated, which is a treatment center in the Portland area. I'm going to do just a very brief overview of our comments and then turn it over to the other members of the panel to give you some specifics about each of the areas that I plan to do a little overview. I want to say that some of my comments probably Senator Carter and Senator Shields could say more eloquently than I. I've been doing this for about 20 years, and so I know they could get up here and say my comments much better. But so you get to have a couple of a little nap here while I talk, if you'd like. I will ring the bell when I have something new to say that you you might want to hear.
You have to be careful because Senator Carter is our sergeant at arms, and. Fortunately, Rosie isn't there in front of you.
The first thing I want to talk about just briefly is that what is addiction? And briefly, it's a chronic relapsing disease. And so treatment is the treatment of that chronic relapsing disease. And a chronic relapsing disease is other relapsing diseases are heart disease and diabetes. So you treat the chronicity very similarly. And in fact, from outcomes, if you look at outcomes, and I think that was presented to you by Bob Nichols, if you look at the outcomes of both other chronic diseases, actually treatment for alcohol and drug, as far as success in regards to adherence to the treatment, is as good, and in fact, in some cases, better. Most of the treatment in Oregon is done in private small businesses. All of the residential is done by private small businesses. Some outpatient is still done by counties. So this is not growing government, if you will. These are private, nonprofit and profit organizations that provide this service for the state of Oregon. And the other good news I have for you, so the bell, and that is that there is evidence-based treatment, and we are using those in Oregon. The second area I want to talk about is the cost-effectiveness of treatment. One of the things that, as I served on the subcommittee for the Oregon Health Services Commission subcommittee on alcohol and drug addiction and mental health, is that we went through the same procedure about prioritizing alcohol and drug services like all other medical services. And lo and behold, you know, I sat on that committee, and this is several years ago, and came to the committee feeling a little like the stepchild of medicine, because alcohol and drug and mental health treatment was always kind of seen as the stepchild, never as the part of healthcare, important part of healthcare. Well, lo and behold, what we discovered was that as we sat there and listened to the evidence about the effectiveness of treatment, the list, the A&D became higher and higher on that list. And it got to the point where it's now 188 out of 736. So when you talk about, and you're thinking about prioritizing, the prioritizing has happened based on good research. And so you don't need to go, you don't have to go through all that again. The fact is that A&D, by doing it, will save lives and will save money.
Senator Carter,
can you tell me if you had your druthers and you could advise the commission in terms of where A&D would be in that number of 700 and some odd, where do you think it rightfully belongs and should be?
Well, because I was a member of the subcommittee, I guess I would have to say that I think 188, when we compared it to other diseases and we went through the same process, I think 188 is right on the button. Okay. Because of the two things. One is the death rate. We know that 5%, if you do not treat alcohol and drug, 5% of those untreated will die of the disease within 5 years. So we know that. And then when you look at the prevention piece, which is the other thing we looked at in the health plan, it's preventative in that it prevents other complications, other medical complications like hospitalizations. To give an example of that, a couple of years ago, Kaiser did a very small study to look at how the difference between people that came in under A&D and got service and those that didn't. One case they looked at was a person on methadone. Before they went on methadone, they had seen the doctor 77 times in the last 6 months. When they started them in treatment, they saw the doctor once in the next 6 months. That led Kaiser then to put methadone treatment as part of their regular insurance. So that's the kind of savings. It's not just hospitalization in the medical, but seeing the doctor for all sorts of other problems that can be part of and be driven by A&D. The other thing is infection. You save because of the infectious diseases like HIV and hepatitis C. So if you treat folks, they aren't as apt to become infected. And if they are infected, they're less apt to infect others if they're in treatment. So those are some other big, I think they use the word hydraulics. I guess that's the popular word. That's where some very big savings. Then you look at savings around the social issues, domestic violence, child welfare. You look at corrections, unemployment. Big savings. In fact, there was a study done several years ago about the cost savings here in Oregon, and it looked like $7. For every dollar you spend in treatment, you save $7 in future costs. In the RAND study, it was between $7 and $10. So that was a national study, but in a local study. So that's why prioritizing makes all the sense in the world to me, and also making sure that A&D is part of that priority, because you're going to save money in other areas by doing that. The final thing that, two things. One is, you've already made a big investment in these private small businesses over the period of time. If you start, as has already happened, you'll see that infrastructure shrink and shrink and shrink. So then when you want to do it again, it's going to cost a lot more money to start up again. So that's the other piece of cost efficiency. And then finally, this is where I want to really ring the bell for this is sort of the new thing that I want to say. And that has to do with stigma. One of the things about alcohol and drug and mental health treatment that isn't true of other medical problems is that there's a stigma attached. And I've watched it happen in this room. Last time when I was before you in the last session, there were some people here that were in treatment. And as you ask questions, not you, but as the committee, ask questions of them, many of the women started crying. And they started hanging their heads down when they started talking about their lives, because they were very ashamed. Now, I want to say to you, if somebody sitting here has got heart disease, and they're pleading with you to make sure that heart disease that heart disease is high on your priority list, they're not going. They may cry because of their frustration, but they're not going to cry and hang their head because of the shame of it. And so what I'm asking you, I'm sort of challenging you, is that every time stigma raises its ugly head in conversations that you have with your colleagues, that you join me and your fellow legislators who are in recovery to stamp out the stigma about that, so that your decisions are based on logic and data-driven information, and not based on stigma. So, with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague.
We have an overflow, and there's people in room 50, so would you please, before you testify, identify yourself for the record so they know in the other room who's talking. Thank you.
My name is Rita Sullivan, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I'm the executive director of a program in Jackson County, and this is my 24th year with them. So I'm graying with the program, and I want to offer some perspective relative to one of the treatment components that I'm most passionate about, and that is the treatment of parents with their children, most notably women with children, but we do also have custodial fathers and their babies in treatment. This passion of mine, I think it's the most significant thing that's happened to this field. It's about 10 years in the making now, and to me it revolutionized treatment, and I'll tell you why I think that in a minute. But my passions are underscored and supported by the empirical data that support that these programs save immense human and economic costs. They're evidence-based, and they have strong evaluation components. They are primary prevention and primary treatment at the same time. They are the best way to curb the next generation of alcoholic addicts. What we know in most cases is that mothers and their children, or fathers and their children, do better when they stay together. I want to diverge a little bit from this topic for, just to tell you that in recent years, and it hasn't always been this way, alcohol and drug services have become so well integrated into the Department of Human Resources that there is now consensus that drug treatment is an essential component of any plan to move people from welfare to work, out of the criminal justice system, or children out of foster care. Treatment within the programs within the public sector have evolved in very parallel ways with things you're very familiar with, the Family Preservation and Reunification Acts of Child Welfare, the Medicaid waivers, welfare reform, the benchmarks, Oregon benchmarks that targeted reducing the number of drug-affected babies, and all sorts of issues that have been sort of creating a map for our progression forward. Now there's no doubt that our partners across the Department of Human Resources recognize that their services are often wasted unless we address the underlying fundamental issue of addiction. Our success at getting the word out by both the legislative actions that have come to support this, the field, and our partners' efforts have paid off. There is now today such a tremendous demand for treatment. It's growing. It's burgeoning. People rely on it, from drug courts to child welfare, with ask the laws being what they are, having 1 year to resolve parental problems. There's such a reliance on it. There was already wait lists, and those are growing and made worse by recent cuts. We have, out of mandates, placed people at AFS and child welfare and criminal justice and juvenile justice to identify people early on who need treatment and get them into treatment. These early identification efforts are also paying off for getting people into treatment, but it's really unfair to identify people who need services and then have a closed door when they get there, or to create a mandate to get your child back and not be able to comply with what you have to, or jam up the drug court because the judges can't mandate the treatment that's required. For compliance.
I am going to ask you to speed up your testimony.
Okay.
We have about 5.
I'll pick a cogent point, I think, and that is that when we opened these programs, I was stunned. It was 10 years ago, and I walked in and asked people in there, very young women, probably teenagers, late teenagers, how many children they already had in the system, and invariably they said 2 or 3. It took me at that point 1 second to realize that they were trying to do it right. And if you take the children away, they're going to have another child to try to do it right again. That is not the answer. But it told me then that we needed to develop aggressive outreach programs. And I want to just conclude with telling you that we have done such a good job in partnership with the medical community that we're identifying pregnant women on their first prenatal visits and getting them into treatment. And we have research that I can show you, statistically significant outcomes in the reduction of NICU days for people who participate in these education programs and those that don't. And I would submit to you that a single child saved from a stay in neonatal care would pay for a lot of intervention. In fact, I've said I know of one who would have paid to operate our program for an entire year. With that, I'll end my comments. Thank you.
Rita, would you explain what NICU is?
It's the neonatal intensive care unit.
Thank you.
And Rita, when you come back, you owe Rosa some money.
You know, that's the only one I blew, but...
That's right.
I acknowledge that, and I'll pay with a smile.
Okay. All right, let's go.
Oh, sure.
Rick.
Hi, I'm Rick Tlevin, and I'm the Executive Director of Best Care Treatment Services, and I'm Mental Health Director for Jefferson County in Central Oregon. And I want to thank Senator Winters and the committee for allowing us to speak. And I also want to appreciate the difficult work that the committee has to do, and also the creative thinking I've been seeing out of this legislative session There's been some very serious dialogue and very serious thinking. I want to appreciate the process that's gone on so far. As a mental health director, one of the things I've seen is that A&D treatment, addiction is one of the hydraulics, as we've said, of social services and corrections here. It's a very small budget, but it the problem affects many of the social services throughout the state. You take away that budget and you increase costs dramatically throughout. As a mental health director of in a small county, I have the opportunity to look at my hospitalizations in a very fine detail. I look at the cases each one, each month. And one of the things I see on the mental health side as far as hospitalization is the folks that we have the most difficulty with who are repeaters, who get in the hospital and stay there a long time, are either people with serious mental illnesses but also with an addiction. The suicidal alcoholic who keeps showing up at the ER and their only problem really is alcoholism. And methamphetamine-induced psychosis, which becomes a growing and growing problem. You take away treatment, and largely treatment, outpatient treatment is getting defunded in the state already. Then you it becomes very difficult to treat that problem. On a second level in outpatient counseling and mental health, you end up working a lot with depression, anxiety, and childhood trauma. All three of those things are intimately related to addiction, and you don't have the resource to treat the addiction, then you end up spinning your wheels for many of the cases, not all, but many. And in working with kids and their parents, so much of your time is spent teaching structure and helping parents deal with their addictions. And again, you take away the addiction treatment, and you're taking away one of the most effective parts of treatment of the mental health system. Finally, from my perspective, addiction treatment is one of the most effective components of the mental health system, and as it stands now, it's largely getting defunded. I've seen in my outpatient treatment services in Central Oregon, basically 80% of the funding's gone away in the last month or two for state funding. So we end up shoveling up the mess of addiction, dealing with the consequences, but defunding the ability to treat the problem. And this is, let me just finish with a story. A couple months ago, in treatment, people actually get better. And that's one of the more amazing things about this. A couple months ago, I was at the video store, and I step out, and this guy drives up in a cherry red Jeep, brand new, jumps out, and he walks up to me and shakes my hand and says, "You saved my life." And I started chatting with him, and I knew him 3 years earlier when he was a suicidal, homeless alcoholic. And being homeless in Central Oregon takes some guts because there are no bridges to stay under, and it's well below freezing every night. And he was suicidal when I knew him. Well, right now he's a industrial X-ray technician. He makes more money than I do. He's been 3 years clean and sober. That's the miracles you see in A&D treatment. That's the real changes you see. And he's paying more taxes than I do. And that's the change that you take away when you defund A&D treatment. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Sheila.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Sheila North, and I am representing ADAPAL, the Association of Drug and Alcohol Program Managers. And I am also the executive director of DePaul Treatment Centers. We have residential and outpatient treatment services in Washington County and Multnomah County, and we treat both youth and adults. My comments are really going to fall under one sort of theme, and that is pay now or pay later. Addiction and drug abuse are not new problems. They've been around forever, and they'll continue to be around for much longer than we will. All use of alcohol and other drugs starts the same. It provides escape. For some, it never progresses beyond occasional indulgence. For others, it becomes a lifelong illness. Alcoholism and other drug abuse and addiction affect 1 out of 3 Americans. It is our nation's number one public health problem. It is ubiquitous. The illness affects people from all walks of society, and in fact, I know of at least 3 members of your body who are in recovery and several more who have been affected by the drug addiction or alcoholism of a family member. Each person with addiction affects at least 25 others, including family, friends, colleagues, employers, and government institutions. It causes mental illness, job loss, stress-related illness, and millions of dollars. Every day you can open your newspaper and find references to the consequences of addiction and alcoholism. In a quick review of yesterday's Oregonian, I found, and this was a very quick review, I found 3 mentions. One was Calvin Klein returning to rehab. Another was the issue of cocaine dependence in an article about a Forest Park murder. And drug abuse problems with the Trailblazers. I think they get mentioned every day in the Oregonian, but nonetheless, we've not progressed very far in our understanding of compassion. Because alcohol and other drugs affects judgment and inhibition, people under the influence behave badly and out of control, and they embarrass themselves and they embarrass us. Hence the stigma. While science has progressed in its understanding of the illness and effective treatment, it is a brain disease.
Written testimony.
Pardon me?
You have written testimony.
I do.
Can you give it to us? And can you kind of summarize? I have 6 pages of individuals who also would like to testify. So if those of you who have written testimony could give that to us and kind of summarize it for us, it would help a lot.
Okay, I will provide written testimony. Let me just offer a couple of examples of the pay now, pay later. One example is a young woman who went through our treatment center, whose name is... doesn't matter, but I'll call her Anna. She went through treatment 3 times, and the 3rd time was successful. She became a mentor, helping other young people with addiction problems, and she is now attending Portland State in pre-med. I estimate that her earning power over the next 40 years is considerable, and that the cost of treatment, the return on investment, will be significantly more, probably exponentially more than what the cost of her treatment was. So I would also like to end by saying that President Bush, in his State of the Union, mentioned his priority that people who have access to treatment. And he spoke directly to those still suffering from the illness, saying, you too can experience the miracle of recovery. We can pay now or we can pay later, but we can't avoid paying. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Committee, I thank you very much for this time. I am Dennis Doherty. I am a Vice President with JBL&K Risk Services in Portland, but my position here is, I guess, to give you a live example of somebody in recovery. I am a recovering alcoholic and addict. I have been in recovery for 20 years. June 13th of this year at 8:30 a.m. when I walked up the stairs of DePaul Treatment Centers will be 20 years for me. Before I walked into DePaul Treatment Centers, my life was an absolute disaster. I had come out of the Air Force and became full bloom into my drinking. I was terminated from every single job that I had. We had 4 children at the time. That ended up in a divorce. I had spent many nights in jails throughout the state. I know I spent spent nights in jail in the city of Portland, in Hillsborough, and in Tillamook. My wife and family after the divorce were on welfare. I've had several DUIs, several accidents where the police were called. I've used the system. I was sucking off the system as much as possible. And because of the great treatment from the state, that this was paid for by the state, when I walked into DePaul Treatment Centers, I had no nickels, no job, no insurance. And there I understood what it was to be an alcoholic. And I want to make one point here, and I'll be brief about it. You may hear testimony that getting somebody into treatment who is not ready does not pay. That is not the case. I am a live proof that I had no intention when I went into DePaul. I went in there because I was forced to go in there. I had no intention of quitting drinking and no idea that I was an alcoholic until about 3 weeks into it. And it dawned on me like a God shot that all of a sudden, reading my life story, sitting there looking at it, I could not avoid that reality. My life has come back. I've never been fired from a job again. I hardly ever go to jail. I don't get tickets. I contribute to the community as best I can. I serve on three separate nonprofit boards and do whatever I can in that way. This year, I paid $27,000, the year 2002, to the state of Oregon in taxes alone. And life is
what
good.
Your job?
Pardon?
Nothing. We would like to have your job.
Well, I'm hanging on to this one if I can. And
I need you to wrap it up.
I am wrapping it up. I just want to be thankful to the state for what they have provided for me, because if without the state, I would not have been able to get treatment to turn that around.
I'm going to ask, and I'm going to call the others up, and please stick to your 2 minutes. We have a lot of people who want to testify, and then I'm going to call up now Bob Wright, calling up individuals who live more than 100 miles, and then Carrie McCullough from Deschutes County, and then on deck, who will follow them, will be Linda Fleming and Karen Gillette. Hi, Bob.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Bob Wright, Eastern Oregon Alcoholism Foundation in Pendleton. And what I wish to share is included in a letter. I will be very brief. I served 33 years in corrections. That was my career. In the last 12 and a half years as a prison superintendent. And my message is between 70% and 80% of all of those persons that I helped manage for all those years had an alcohol or drug issue that contributed to their being locked up. My interest is, I know that treatment works, And I'm interested that addicts and alcoholics have an opportunity for treatment and to avoid the consequences of addiction. There are four bills that are circulating in the Revenue Committee. One was heard this morning, 2804. Those bills have a different figures, but they propose a 10-cent tax per drink on the alcohol beverage, beer. And I advocate for the passage of those and advocate that the beer tax may become the way and the means to provide the needed treatment that's out there. That's my story. That's my message. And thank you.
And you're sticking to it. Hi, Carrie.
Thank you.
We've known each other a lot of years.
Hi, I'm Carrie McCullough. Unlike most of the people that you will hear today speak in support of the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program, I lobbied pretty vehemently against Measure 44 in 1996. I sent out group emails and bulk mailings to all my friends and family all across the state urging them to vote no. As you probably can imagine, I was a smoker in those days. I smoked a pack a day, and my husband smoked two packs a day. So ultimately, Measure 44 did pass, and I quit smoking. And since I administrate our household finances, I gently urged my husband to do the same. I went on, we actually quit with benefit of efforts from our local coalition that were funded by Measure 44. I went on to chair that local coalition. I now sit on the statewide Tobacco-Free Coalition of Oregon and also coordinate cessation programs for Cascade Health Services at Central Oregon Community Hospital in Redmond. I have a couple of concerns. One of my main talking points when I was so vehemently opposing Measure 44 was worry that maybe the revenue would not be spent in the manner defined by the ballot measure, and I use that pretty far and wide with my opposition communication. I then realized I was wrong. I've told that story on myself many times, extolling the successes of the program. And so disconcerting now, would certainly not have wanted to be proved wrong, or excuse me, proved right at this late date. One of the things I do in my cessation program is see inpatients who are interested in quitting and have been able to refer heavily to the Oregon Quit Line as an immediate means of action for people who are ready to take action today. And it's a matter of great concern that it's not there. Smokers often ask me if it's free. I say it's not free. It's prepaid. You've paid for it over and over every time you bought a pack of cigarettes since 1997. Please make sure our program comes back.
Thank you. Linda Fleming and Karen Gillette. On deck is Heather Roberts and Alan Levine. You're coming up next. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you so much for listening to our comments today. I'm Karen Gillette. I'm the program manager for Lane County Public Health. And I simply want to put some emphasis on the need for continued communicable disease capacity within the state of Oregon and a comprehensive public health system. I want to point out in the written information you're receiving that we do have minimum standards that are specific to all of our programs, and I wanted to point out those that are specific to communicable disease. That's encouraging and providing a means for the reporting, monitoring, investigating, controlling communicable disease. Immunizations for our community. We assure early detection, treatment, education, prevention around communicable diseases. We have some statutory responsibility in controlling those diseases, and we have a comprehensive training process for staff as they come on board that are going to do the epidemiological services. Because of the control measures we have a quite a good record in controlling infectious diseases. And I think some of you are familiar with our event in August in Lane County with the 0157 outbreak with our fair. And that was a good example of us communicating. We'd set up a system where we communicate with the medical community, the hospitals, put on the alert that if you see these things, please call us. And because we had that mechanism in place in working with physicians to develop strong partnerships, we were able to get people identified sooner, get them in, and get their care provided, so we reduced further spread of the illness. We have been hearing off and on that because the state and the county health departments received the bioterrorism preparedness funding from CDC, that took care of our communicable disease problems. And it certainly has helped in our infrastructure and in fulfilling some of our needs, but it doesn't address those non-reportable diseases such as TB and when we have to do direct observed therapy. And Lane County's experienced a very tenacious TB outbreak, and we have continued. And so I just want to reemphasize that it is very important that we maintain a very strong communicable disease program, irregardless of the preparedness dollars, because they don't take care of all of it. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Linda Fleming. I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition of Local Health Officials. As I've told this body before, we represent Oregon's 34 local health departments. When you received the prioritization, the public health priorities from Human Services, there were 97 programs in public health programs that were prioritized. Priorities 1 through 5 were around communicable disease and bioterrorism threats.
Priority six, however, is babies first, and I just want to make sure that you understand the very critical connection between those first five priorities and the sixth priority. The nurses used in the babies first program are also used for public health emergencies such as disease response and mass vaccination clinics, or when we have other public health threats that are not anticipated. Those public health nurses that are funded through babies first and the match that we're able to receive provide our core public health nurse infrastructure throughout the state. Our most recent review of funding and staffing information shows a core of 58 nursing FTE or full-time equivalents are in place annually because of Baby First and the leveraged funds. 16 of those positions are actually funded by Babies First, and the other 42 are funded through the match that we're able to generate by that program being in place locally. I know I've heard this body ask last week, how does that work? You can call it end loading, I guess, rather than front loading, depending upon the federal waiver, the type of match, the program, the rules, the agreements that you have with the federal government. You can either front load, meaning the match is provided up front and it goes through the state that way, or we get the state general fund at the local level. After we bill, when we've billed for $100 worth of services, then the county gets $60. $40 goes back to the state through OMAP for the match. So it's end-loading the match versus front-loading the match is the best way for me to describe how we see it as working at the local level. You ask, again, why we use nurses in this program. It's because it's a federal requirement for targeted case management.
Thank you. I think I have Heather Roberts, Alan Levine, and then on deck is Scott Snedcore and Sarah Nolte.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I thank you very much for listening to me today. My name is Heather Roberts. I represent the Recovery Association Project for the Recovery Association Project and the Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good. The Metropolitan Alliance for Common Good is a group of 35 to 40 churches. We have almost 40,000 members who participate in this organization. I'm a mother. I'm a single mother of two children. I'm a taxpayer, a homeowner. I have a bachelor's degree in business management, and I'm a recovering addict. I said it in that order because a lot of times if I say that I'm a recovering addict, the stigma associated with that makes people stop listening to me. I'm unemployed, and part of my recovery program causes me to keep honest. It's important for me to stay honest because I spent so much of my life lying. The message sent by cutting the addiction services from the Oregon Health Plan to the rest of the state, I think, increased the stigma. It said to everyone else in the state that addicts are not worthwhile people. They're not important. I have received services transitioning from homelessness and during my transition from being an addict to being a recovering addict. I also received I have also transitioned off of dependency on state aid. I now receive unemployment, but that's through my employer. It's not state aid. I also represent parents who are out of compliance because of the Oregon Health Plan cuts. It's a very disappointing thing, and it creates hopelessness in the addict that's trying to recover when they are facing being out of compliance with custody hearings because the cuts to the Oregon Health Plan and their treatment, they're out of compliance and they can't get custody of their children because of their being out of compliance. And it's hard to sit down with an addict like that and try to give them hope when they're hopeless. It's like they don't know what to do. I sat with a girl and just held her hand while she cried because she's like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm not going to get my children back because I'm out of compliance with what the judge told me I had to do to get my children back. I'm here, and I vote, and I want it to be heard. Thank you for listening.
Just so that you know that alcohol and drug was not the only programs.
I'm aware of that, but I wanted to represent my own views.
I just wanted for the record so that those who are listening don't get the misunderstanding that the cuts were directed towards one population group. It was not.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for letting me speak here today. If Rosie was here, I'd probably have to put something in her belly, but maybe I can avoid that. I am a co-chair of the the Recovery Association Project. Sometimes I call it RAP. Rosie would probably get something there. And I'm also a co-chair of the Metropolitan Alliance. As Heather mentioned, it's a group of 35 faith-based groups, trade unions, schools alliances, representing about 40,000 folks in the metro, Portland metro area. We have some support here today from those groups. And I want you to know that these 40,000 folks I'm talking about in conversations we've had, they support us not because it's the right thing to do, but rather because they see it as being in their self-interest to do so. I am also involved as a co-chair in the Recovery Association Project, and we represent about 400 folks there. We're also organizationally, we have a relationship with the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, who are well represented here this evening, this morning. I just want to tell a little bit about myself. I'm a CADC1. I sit on the local alcohol and drug planning committee in Clackamas County. Our staff liaison, Melinda Mowry, is here to see, today. And we are discussing this outcome-based treatment philosophy that seems to be working really well. We understand it takes sometimes seven times for an addict to get it. I have a college degree, and in pursuit of my college degree, I was the president of my honor society at junior college, and I'm a member of an honor society at PSU. Again, I mentioned I'm a CADC, I'm a counselor, so I'm speaking from the perspective of a provider. But I'd like now to tell you who I really am. I come from a struggle. 35 years of being homeless, of being addicted, living under bridges, eating out of dumpsters, begging for my food. I've been a thief. I've been in prison. I've been in jail. I've spent time in mental institutions because it was obvious that I was crazy. There's this stigma that associated with my disease that made it very difficult. Really briefly, I lived in a cave of addiction. I saw the light. My mother was outside. My friends were outside, the police officers, parole officers, neighbors, saying, come on out, it's fine. I swear to you, it was not that I did not want to come out of that cave. I tell you, I could not come out. I did not know how to come out. And the way I got out was someone who had lived in that cave came in there, took me by the hand, and led me out.
Mr. Levine, you mentioned 35 faith-based groups. Could you provide later to this body a list or the identification of those groups?
I certainly can, Senator Winters. And while I might not have that with me, I can certainly transmit that to you.
Thank you very much.
We're having our assembly on May 13th. Representative Westland and Representative Bates, I believe, are going to be there. So perhaps I'll speed this up. I want you to know that, like Heather, when I heard the cuts, I felt targeted. I felt that somehow the state was telling me that addicts aren't as valuable as other folks, and maybe there's more to that.
I think that, and I do want to reiterate that. It was not about the addiction. It was about the lack of funds, and included in that was a huge number of seniors. It was kids. You look at every element that we're talking about that exists for programs for people in the state. They were all affected by it.
Right.
And I do need to cut you off because I've got others.
I will finish with this. I just want to remind this committee, and you've heard testimony here, that there is a connection between A&D treatment and healthy communities. RAP, the Work and Recovery Association Project, proves that. We have made those connections, and we have grown thereby. And I want you to know that I also am here. I vote, and I want to be heard. Thank you.
We've got Scott and Sarah. And on deck is Stephen Liaza, Angela Kimball, Sharon Bemis. And I'm going to stick to the 2 minutes because I'll never get through. We'll be here till 7 o'clock tonight if I don't.
Hello, my name's Scott Snedeker, and I live in
Snedeker.
Yeah, it's Snedeker. Thank you for inviting public testimony. Just real quickly, I want to mention that the reason I'm here is that in the world of consumers of mental health, of which I was one at one time, luckily I'm not one now, people do recover. And I'm lucky because I've been through recovery. I gave Senator Gordley some information that she can share with the group. But I just want to say that the state needs to take a look at making sure that mental health consumers are represented at all levels within the mental health system. We tend to have other people represent us, and that doesn't really get us the services that we need. I'm going to give you a solution now, and the main solution is going to be to provide an Office of Consumer Affairs within the state mental health division. Not everybody is looking out and advocating for consumers in that division, and I believe that that's since the demise of the Office of Consumer Technical Assistance, that will be a way for consumers to have advocacy built into the state bureaucracy. And that's the main reason I'm here, and thank you.
Sarah. Thank you for your time. My name is Sarah Nolte. I'm from the Office of Mental Health Alternatives. I'm the president and founder. I also sit on the board of the Mental Health Association. I'm a former volunteer with Multnomah County Consumer Liaison before our position was cut due to the 28 failing. I'm also a trained peer counselor and a mental health advocate. I have 18 years' experience being diagnosed with severe and persistent mental illness. I have been involuntarily hospitalized 5 times, not because I've been a danger to myself or others, but because of limited community alternatives to hospitalization. I believe I'm no longer mentally ill. I have cured myself with education, nutrition, strong social support, and vigilant self-care. I urge you to fund community mental health programs to prevent expensive, abusive, revolving door hospitalizations. Thank you.
Thank you. Stephen, and Angela, and Sharon.
Madam Chair, we changed the lineup just a little
bit. Did you?
Yes.
Why did you do that to me?
Well, we thought we'd make it.
Are you going to speak for the entire group because you have a number that are here?
Yes. No, they're going to speak for themselves, but we'll come up as a group. But I'll start out. Madam Chair, my name's Stephen Loaiza. I'm Executive Director of NAMI Oregon, and I am so thankful Rosie's not here because I understand she has a leafy green diet and likes green.
But her cause is worthy.
Yes, it is worthy. I'd just like to give you a real quick background of who I am and where I come from. That's 2 hours?
2 minutes.
Oh, 2 minutes. I'm a small business owner, was a small business owner, ran my own business. I have to tell you that I provided my employees with insurance. I felt like that was one of my responsibilities. I am also the father of someone who has a severe and persistent mental illness. I have also experienced teenage suicide in my immediate family. So while I am a executive director of NAMI Oregon, I have been through the fires. And I want people to know that, but I don't want your sympathy. I just want you to know that I have been there and it brought me to this place today. What I want to say today is that treatment works. There is no question about treatment working. The thing of it is we need the resources in order to make it work. I look at it as an investment in Oregon in our future rather than an expense. My model for recovery is like a three-legged milk stool. Do people remember the three-legged milk stools? I mean, the three legs in the recovery process are housing. Got to have safe, stable housing. You need professional services. That's jobs, training, medication, therapy, all of those kind of things. And then you need family and community supports. And with those three things, recovery is possible. It is a fact. I just want to give you a real quick synopsis, not even a synopsis, a bullet point. The World Health Organization and the Harvard Medical School in 1999 did a survey, and 4 of the top illnesses in the world are mental illnesses. 4 out of the top 10. And if you include alcohol and drug, That means 5 out of the top 10. I have given you some information. There's information about housing. We haven't had a chance to talk to about housing, but it's crucial for recovery. And one of our projects in Clackamas County is in Jeopardy because there is no general assistance. Thank you, Madam Chair. I have 10 pounds of information in a 5-pound bag. Sorry.
Hi, my name is Betsy Hansen, and I'm Executive Director of NAMI Washington County. We are the second largest county in the state, and I'm going to kind of read some of the notes I wrote. I think it'll go faster, keep me in my time limit there. I'd like to give a couple of examples of true tragedies since my last visit down here, and one is an example of a young man that showed up at my NAMI office on a bicycle. He had been sent to me from, interestingly enough, the employment office, of which I have not given a presentation to, or they don't have any of my brochures, but somehow they knew to send him to me due to lack of a crisis center in Washington County. So sort of a bullet from where we went from there, I invited him in, he and his bicycle, and we called the crisis center. The crisis line. We still have a line, so I did call a crisis line. I was able to get him an appointment, as there is a doctor that works with that crisis line. He did see him 3 days later. I do want to mention that crisis line is in great jeopardy as of July 1st of remaining in service. Doctor did give him an evaluation. Then he spoke to, as well as myself, following up with our four mental health providers in Washington County that are nonprofits that we contract with. All four are not taking any new clients on Oregon Health Plan Standard. They are only taking plus due to the fact they are maintaining medical needy and Oregon Health Plan Standard to some extent within their own services, and those they do not want to tell those clients that they don't have any services, so they are not taking any new. Needless to say, I still have that young man's bicycle in my building. He's checking in with me every other day. I am not a professional caseworker. I, like Stephen, also am a family member and have actually 3 family members that suffer from a major mental illness in my family, and so I do have some personal experience. However, I am a staff of 1. Second example happens to be happening right now at St. Vincent's Hospital. Got a call from a gal who has been down here with us as well.
I'm going to have to cut you off. I apologize. But I have about 5 other your NAMI members here. I have darts here. I have others. And so I'm going to have you stick to your 2 minutes.
Okay.
Hello, my name is Sharon Bemis. I was down here about a month ago. Mm-hmm. And the full pamphlet that was passed out to you, this is my daughter. She gave up her life battling schizophrenia. When Measure 28 was passed, she lost her general assistance. And just like Heather said, the message came through that she was no good. And it wasn't from you all. I agree. It was from the voices in her head. She couldn't take any more, and she gave up her life. She took her life. I'm here on behalf of NAMI and the mentally ill and for Farah. We don't want to see anybody else this happen to. I also had another paper passed out. It's an article from St. Paul, Minnesota newspaper. We used to live in Wisconsin, and a good friend of Farah's told me about this article, and I emailed it to a lot of you. It's titled, Budget Cuts Challenge Oregon's Character, Tough Choices Put Quality of Life at Risk. And it's not just the life, quality of life, it is the lives. It is the lives at risk. You know, and when I was down here last month, I said, please, let's do something. We need something done urgently. These people can't wait. We need to act quickly. And, you know, some of the senators and representatives have taken action, and I have to say I'm very thankful, especially to Senator Morsette, who is trying to get a beer tax passed now. And I want to come in, and I'm urging everyone to support that for the mentally ill. In times of crisis, we need to do the right thing. I know that some people have vowed no new taxes, but in this case, we can't leave our people or vulnerable people behind. We must take them with us. And I am just asking you, please do the right thing.
Thank you. On board.
I'm Angela, and I was called earlier, and out of line.
And behind Angela, I want the next group that's on board, Les Bush, John Swartz, and Larry Tang.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I was before you a couple weeks ago, and you heard the story about my son, my 16-year-old whose head doesn't hurt anymore since he started taking mental health medication. And how before he was stabilized for bipolar, he was in the back of police cars, he was in crisis treatment wards, and he was in schools with stainless steel lockup rooms. And that how now, with medications and with supports, he's actually at a regular high school. He's looking forward to getting his first job. And how in just a year and a half, he'll be an adult. He has a chronic and devastating illness that can be managed. But will there be the medications and supports he needs? Will he look forward to college and a job? Or at great cost, will he end up in a psychiatric or forensic ward? I ask that you look into our faces and that you understand that our families, our lives, and our futures will be indelibly marked by the choices you make in the days and weeks ahead. I'd also like to remind you that the current cost of serving adults with mental health disorders includes the legacy of decades without access to the new generation of medications and best practices that have given my son the promise of full and productive life. Without adequate funding, the cost savings that effective and efficient treatment can bring simply will not be realized. And lastly, I'd like to add that there are many of us in the community who have been poised to partner with the mental health organizations and with the state to implement best practices and evidence-based treatment models in the treatment of mental health. The current budget crisis has detracted from our ability to move forward and invest in the future of a productive Oregon. Thank you.
Les, John, Larry, and on deck, Bruce Bishop and Mark Nelson.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, I'm Les Bush from Oregon Health Sciences University, where I'm an assistant professor and director of the Children's Psychiatric Day Treatment Center. I'm also here as president of the Oregon Association of Treatment Centers, the DARTS folks, Day Treatment for Children and Adolescents. As you all probably know, there was a significant reduction in DARTS programs as a result of Measure 28. Over 160 placements were lost. Many programs are telling me that if this goes forward at the level that they're currently funded, they'll have to close in July. They won't make it to the next biennium at all. But I'd also like to add something about my own program, the situation. We're a training program for child psychiatrists. And our division director of child psychiatry gave this information for me to share. The Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at OHSU is the only training program for child and adolescent psychiatrists in Oregon. Many, if not most, child and adolescent psychiatrists who practice in this state are graduates of our program. The severe reductions in support for the OHSU Day Treatment Program will probably lead to reductions in faculty size, in the size of the training program, and will undoubtedly impact the quality of the training experience we are able to provide for the next generation of Oregon's child and adolescent psychiatrists. I have with me Larry Tang and John Schwartz, who will elaborate on their particular situations.
Madam Chair, my name is Laurie Tang. I'm director of Polk Adolescent Day Treatment Center located in Dallas, Oregon. We serve Marion, Polk, Yamhill counties. Psychiatric day treatment is the last community-based service available to children and families with emotional disabilities. And with the loss of that service that's community-based, the next option is to provide services at a higher cost, out-of-home placement in institutions. We would like to retain that service availability within their home communities where children and families can stay together and not be forced to be separated. A 45% cut that we sustained is disproportionate to other service cuts that have occurred within children's services, and at that level of cut, as Les mentioned, programs will be forced to close. We will be one of those who will not be able to sustain that level of cut. We'd appreciate your consideration of restoring some of those cuts so we can retain this valuable service. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is John Schwartz. I'm the executive director of Poyama Day Treatment. We are an independent. We serve Polk, Yamhill, and Marion County children with emotional disturbance. And just piggyback on some of the things that you've heard so far regarding this 45% cut. Like many programs, our program would probably shut down. And as of February 1st, our program served 20 kids, were funded to serve 20 kids. We're now funded to serve just 11 kids. And a cut to this extent makes running an entire program a very difficult endeavor. And indeed, since February 1st, many of our programs statewide have sent children home in the middle of their treatment where they simply weren't ready to transition back home. Or in many cases, many of these children are now needing more expensive residential and other psychiatric care that can be 3 to 5 times more expensive than the day treatment that we provide. Obviously, I'm very troubled by this cut, 45%. It seems extremely inequitable to me. I'm also troubled by the process by which it was given. Our programs have a 30-year history of providing very high-quality service. Nobody ever came to us and said we have difficulty with the manner in which these services are being provided. We're award-winning programs throughout the state. And a 45% cut, as you're hearing, really represents more than just a cut to programs. It represents a possible dismantling of this entire cog in the system of caring for children. We managed to keep kids in their home, in their community, out of hospitals, and why eliminate this system is something that has never been explained to us, and so we feel that this cut is as I said, inequitable, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mark Nelson, Bruce Bishop. There's Bruce Bishop. On deck is Amy Baker, Jan Lacey, and Sandy Bumpus. Go ahead, Bruce.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, and I'm appearing this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I appreciate your taking me out of order. I can't speak for Mark Nelson, but he will be able to speak for himself shortly, I'm sure. I will be brief, and I want to bring to you the perspective of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and the significance of finding ways to continue the level of support that the state has given in recent years to the Oregon Health Plan. We are well aware of the social, the health, and the financial consequences of the fiscal decisions that have to be made this year. But we believe it's particularly important that this subcommittee understand the economic realities of the budget decisions that you'll be making. The Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems has been one of the strongest supporters of the Oregon Health Plan throughout its existence. The cornerstone of the Oregon Health Plan has been its emphasis on making rational choices and prioritizing services for the good of all Oregonians. We're committed to continuing advocating for those principles. Oregon hospitals are the economic backbone of their communities, particularly in rural Oregon. Hospitals are among the major employers in their communities, and hospital payments ripple throughout the local economy. For every dollar spent in the healthcare sector, the State Employment Department tells us $1.60 is realized in related services. For every state dollar that is spent in the Medicaid program, $1.50 is returned to Oregon with federal matching grants. This means a dollar invested in Medicaid will produce $2.50 in healthcare services. That $2.50 in health services will ripple through the economy, resulting in approximately $4 in unrelated economic activity beyond the healthcare system. Let me state that differently. Every dollar that's cut from the Medicaid program and the Oregon Health Plan is not just the loss of $1, it's the loss of $4 to local economies in Oregon. Unlike other public programs, when you cut a dollar from the Oregon Health Plan, you take four times that amount out of local economies. That doesn't mean that those other programs are unimportant. It does mean that the consequences of your decisions will have significantly greater effects in healthcare and on the Oregon Health Plan. I've included in my testimony, and I will not go through it now, a recent report of the from the state of Texas about the economic consequences of hospital and health plan cuts. As you can see, there are significant economic consequences, and we would urge the subcommittee to do everything it can to continue the Oregon Health Plan, not only for the patients and the providers, but for the general health of Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bishop. I will encourage the members to read your testimony.
Thank you.
Amy Baker, Jan Lacey, if they're not, you need to be ready to come up when you're on deck. And Sandy Bumpus.
Chair Winters and members of the committee.
And then following them is Stephanie Boyer.
My name is Amy Baker, and I work
and for Shirley Kimball
for Multnomah County Mental Health and Addiction Services Division. I'm a children's mental health administrator. And my job is essentially to ensure that kids and families don't fall through the cracks and that we provide services to them that works. And I just have to make a quick observation. Senator Morse, I think I graduated from high school with your daughter. And that being said, you can't discount everything I'm about to say because you just figured out my age. In Multnomah County, we're really excited about, excited and horrified by what's occurring within the mental health field currently. We're obviously being defunded, but it's created a certain energy that I haven't seen before. We've become acutely aware of how limited resources are and how much we need to expand those and how good we need to be at our jobs. We're poised and ready to start and to continue using services that we know work. There's so much research available in terms of what brings families into treatment, what helps families get better, and what prevents families from dropping out of treatment. One of the pieces that's very concerning to me is that although children's mental health services have remained fairly intact, it is going to impact kids that we serve when their parents lose coverage, both for addiction and mental health services. Our guiding philosophy at this point is that in order to do treatment, you have to treat the whole family. The family is a system, and they need to stay together. And that without the addiction services and the mental health services, the outcomes aren't going to be there. And I can tell you, you know, although obviously you've probably heard this before, what happens when you don't provide mental health services for kids and families is that they end up on the streets, they end up in juvenile justice, they end up in the hospital, they end up in residential, and they end up using the adult mental health system. And there certainly is a greater cost if you don't do the right thing when they come in and when they need the service. And just to sum up, I sat in a meeting on Monday for a kid who is moving from residential system back to his mainstream school. And
you used up your time talking to the good finger here.
Really good story, too.
Sandy and Dan are not here, so I'm going to proceed. I'm Stephanie Boyer. And I brought a picture of my family to show you. I'm a Multnomah County resident in the city of Fairview. And my husband and I are the legal guardians of our 12-and-a-half-year-old niece, Tara, who was diagnosed with several mental health disorders, which qualify her for Oregon Health Plan coverage. Her disorder-related behaviors include aggressive and dangerous actions when she becomes agitated or frustrated, such as hitting her head against the wall, kicking, hitting, or attacking others. She also hides under blankets or furniture when fearful and has great difficulty accepting compliments or feeling good about herself. She is artistic and creative. Her Butterflies poem was published in the Young Americans Poetry Digest for 2002. She likes cheetahs, the color blue, rollerblading, and clothes from Old Navy. In December, Tara threatened me with a knife and refused to drop it even when police were called to intervene. It is important to recognize that this, like many of her behaviors, was a cry for help, a desire to be free from constant fears and anxieties, and to be just like other kids. Tara is currently in a pilot project residential treatment program. In order to provide her and us effective coping techniques, adaptive skills, and the tools to be successful in everyday life. However, due to the limitations of state funding for mental health programs, this pilot's funding will be terminated in June of this year. A unique feature of this program allows children to return to the residential facility for 1 to 2 days after moving back home if needed for crisis stabilization. Not only does this provide better care and consistency for children and families, but it also takes the place of costly repeat hospitalizations that cannot offer the same continuity of services. Tara was hospitalized 4 times in 2002, a total of 6 weeks, costing over $42,000. Now she is in a program that costs the state less and is much more effective. With proper structure, support, and treatment, Tara has strong potential to successfully participate in school and activities with non-disabled peers and to live peacefully with us, parents who love her very much. On April 26th, we will celebrate her 2-year anniversary as a member of our family. Without necessary mental health services, Tara will continue to be a danger to herself and society. Future anniversaries will be marked by the inevitable outcome of injury or death for herself or others instead of a joyful party with cake and presents. This is a matter of life and death, and I strongly urge you to be a voice for our state's mentally ill and their families and to be a voice for life. Thank you.
Attorney General Hardy Myers, I saw you come in. After this lady, right, you want to come up? We're putting them, having them come up on deck.
I'm sorry. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, with your permission, I would like to read a letter.
Oh, you have 2 minutes.
Yes. My name is Shirley Kimball. I belong to the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, Yamhill County. I live in McMinnville, Oregon. Dear Chair and members of the committee, my name is Thomas Lambert, and I'm a consumer of mental health services, which are paid by the Oregon Health Plan. I've been a consumer for 6 years, and during these 6 years, I've been able to make remarkable improvements in my life. I believe I would not have been able to make these without the services I have received.
Mrs. Kimball, the members can read the letter. It would be well if you would just summarize for them, because this will take up more than your 2 minutes.
All right. This man was diagnosed with a schizophrenia called disorganized schizophrenia. I met this man 6 years ago, and he was one of the sickest individuals I have ever seen. The fact that he could write this letter, that at this afternoon he's in a college class, is a tribute to the mental health community mental health services he received and to his perseverance and the support of his community and the fact that he was able to get skill training, vocational training through the mental health services and was able to move from his parents' home into independence. He had not been out of his yard for 2 years prior to the age of 18. He has now been released from that kind of captivity of his mental illness through the services he's received. And he concludes by saying, "We cannot deny mental health treatment without there being dire consequences." Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney General.
Thank you, Chair Winters and members. For the record, Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I appreciate the opportunity to just
Excuse
take a moment.
Excuse me for a moment, Hardy. On deck will be Ed Johnson, Judy Wilson, and Kathy Shake. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members, I appreciate the opportunity to take just a moment to add my word of support to others you've heard on behalf of the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. I don't think that you'll be able to find a program in which the cost-benefit relationship is as dramatically favorable as it is in this one, where for a relatively small investment, we have seen, in combination with the effects also of price increases, as well as the effects of the National Master Settlement Agreement, a dramatic decline in smoking in Oregon, both among adults and teens, which is where most smoking starts, as I think you all know, about 80% or so. And this program, of course, also has the distinction of being one in which the voters, the people of Oregon, have specifically endorsed a commitment of a portion of the cigarette tax revenues for the purposes of this program. But that alone, whether that alone would necessarily support the continuation of the program, certainly I think the effects of it, the contribution that it has made to the decline in smoking in Oregon, strongly commends it to the committee's favorable consideration. I'm as aware as anyone of the many competing pulls you're facing with respect to the resources available, but I do respectfully hope that it will be the subcommittee's decision to allocate a decent budget to this program for next biennium. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Do we have Judy Wilson and Kathy?
Good afternoon. My name.
Come on, sir. You're on deck.
Good afternoon. My name is Edward Johnson, and first off, I'd like to thank Senator Winters for allowing me to speak on a couple other occasions and for taking the time to listen to me. I'm a disabled worker, and I have one suggestion with the Oregon Health Plan, putting all state employees in the Oregon Health Plan. If we're going to let tax dollars work, let's save our own system. I am not an alcoholic or drug addict or mental patient. In the package I'm giving you, I was advised dealing with my disability, if I was claimed I was an alcoholic or mental patient, that I'd get more services. I had two spinal fusions, so I'm looking at possibly a third. I have lower spine that is compressing and crushing. I have facts dealing with all this I'm giving you. I am very frustrated at disabled workers, and I am one that are the ones that are getting pinched by the system, especially for general assistance as well, because we rely on that when workman's comp does not come in place. Sometimes it takes up to years is when documentation will even prove since 1990, 89 was my original injury. Since 1990, I've been fighting. I lived with a disc lodged in my spinal cord for 8.5 years. I was on the verge of committing suicide because of pain. And if it wasn't for State Senator Gary George, I would not be alive today. He pushed to help me with my surgery in 98. I've had another surgery since 2001 when I fell at work because of improper with OSHA stated that was my job's responsibility because I worked in the kitchen. They didn't have rubber mats in the kitchen. My feet went out, put my head in the dish bay. These were on-job injuries, and I'm very frustrated that the workers are the ones who are getting pinched on this one because we pay our taxes. The insurers pay, the workers, the employers pay the taxes on us. And we're the ones being left out. And, you know, it's really frustrating because some of these programs, I'm not disagreeing with some of the way they work. But then again, when it comes to the injured workers, we need to have our voice, and that's what I'm here. And my factual evidence, I've signed many releases in this state, in this building. I don't have a problem with anything in my life being opened. These are medical history on me with MRIs and everything to prove what I'm saying, including a psychological report that when they were trying to say if I would admit to different things that, yes, I'm going to wrap it up in hopefully 30 seconds, that if I would admit to certain things that were not my problems, they could give me further help. My problems were pain because of lodged discs in my spinal cord. I appreciate the time, Senator Winters, and may everybody be blessed, and hopefully to God that nobody has to experience the pain that chronic pain patients like me do, and I really hope you never experience something like that, what I live with today. Thank you.
Thank you. Judy Wilson and Kathy, and on deck is Mitch Anderson and Marie Hudson.
Madam Chair and members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee, I'm Judy Wilson, and I live in the Mid-Valley. I live in Albany, and I do our nonprofits in Corvallis. And I have with me one of my residents. I do Mid-Valley Housing Plus. I began that in 1994, doing support services for people who have a mental illness in Benton County. And Kathy Shack is here with me today to tell you her story. I think she's going to read it quickly, but the impact of the cuts are very significant in Kathy's story. Kathy?
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Kathy Shack, and looking back on my life, I believe I've been mentally ill since early childhood. My symptoms became severe in April of 1993 when I had my first breakdown. Since that time, I've had several additional breakdowns. I have four major mental illnesses: schizoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. I was a teacher for 23 years. I truly loved teaching and received much joy from my students. In August of 2001, I became very ill. My illness became so severe I was unable to continue working. In fact, as a result of an episode which occurred at my workplace, I was taken to the hospital. I had an uncontrollable urge to harm myself. I remain disabled to this day and unable to work. I received Social Security disability benefits. When I first stopped working, I was on the Oregon Health Plan. When I began to receive my Social Security disability benefits, I learned that my income was too high to continue receiving the Oregon Health Plan. I also learned that I am not eligible for Medicare for 2 years. I currently have no medical insurance. I was on the Medically Needy Spend Down program, but lost that coverage in February of this year when the program was cut. I do not have any prescription insurance coverage. My antipsychotic and atypical medication costs $950 a month. I've had to apply to pharmaceutical companies to obtain a scholarship for my medications. I've received 4 scholarships and must reapply every 3 months. However, 4 of my other medications, I learned there were no such scholarships available. I've had to purchase these for my limited disability income. People with mental illness need full prescription coverage. I need prescription coverage. Without my medication, I become psychotic and very suicidal in just 2 days. I'm frightened about the future. Due to state budget cuts, I lost my therapist in February. He was the first therapist who helped me to learn about the path towards recovery. I'm fearful and lost without his guidance. I need a therapist to enable me to function in day-to-day life and one who is aware of the viability of my current prescriptions and those and who has authority to communicate with my clinical psychiatrist. Please be aware of the fact that medications are most important to stabilize mental health. However, the availability of a therapist to supplement and guide is of equal importance. I am very concerned about the current status of mental health programs and the state policy regarding individuals who are suffering with mental illness. I am worried not only for myself, but for all others who are unable to voice their own stories. You need to be there for us. Please stand strong for the programs which help the mentally ill. Thank you for your time and your support.
Thank you. Mitch and Marie Hudson.
I think Judy had something.
May I?
Oh, I'm sorry, didn't you?
No, I just introduced Kathy.
Go ahead, but you have to keep it short. I have about another hour worth of individuals sitting out there in the room.
I understand. Thank you. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about what is happening as far as my son is concerned and as far as the other clients that we see in Mid Valley Housing Plus are concerned. Bruce lives in Corvallis and is 43 years old, diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia when he was 18. Since he has been on the new medication, Clozaril, about 10 years ago now, his life has been totally, totally different. February 1st, he lost the Medically Needy Spend Down program. His medications are $1,157 a month. And his we have received patient assistance for most of these, but additional medical costs now are totaling about $400 a month out of his very limited income of $753 for Social Security, and he makes about $350 on his job. With his medication, he's able to work. He has lost his job coach because of the cuts to the vocational job program at Benton County. He pays that out of pocket now. Since he has been on the medications, he has a home now and a house that he can live in, his dog, his car. He has some quality of life, but without the medications, as Kathy has said, in about 3 to 5 days, he would be in the hospital, which is much more costly. Just to tell you quickly what is happening, Kelly Worth asked me to tell you this.
You know, I'm going to have to cut you off.
Okay.
Sorry. Because we've got others, and you've done more, both of you together, more than the 2 minutes allotted. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, we should have had 4 minutes. Okay.
I did. They were...
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mitchell Anderson. I'm the mental health director in Benton County, and I'm also president of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I had the opportunity to testify a couple weeks ago about the association's priorities for outpatient services, and so you can consider my testimony today an exclamation point to that. I feel very strongly that the priorities that are being set to continue funding of the facility-based high-end services and putting what remains in terms of our money into those services is taking the system backwards. Priorities need to be towards outpatient care. Inpatient care and state hospital care costs in the hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for an individual. Outpatient care costs in the thousands of dollars per year for an individual. Treatment works. Recovery is possible. You can't dismantle the outpatient system and expect that we have any system at all with just the inpatient care. We ask that you look to restoring funding to crisis services, to outpatient mental health and alcohol and drug treatment. We ask that you make that funding flexible, non-categorical, so that local plans can drive how those funds are used locally to meet the needs in our own communities. Those local plans include local stakeholders. They include consumer voice. And we know what will work best in these times of crisis for our clients. That funding for those outpatient services is essential. We have to have it. We just ask you to find it someplace. Thank you.
Marie.
Thank you. My name is Marie Hudson. I'm not going to take 2 minutes because you have my letter. You can read it. Thank you.
Thank you, Marie. You made big points. Ed Lichtenstein, Connie Mueller, and Dr. Labby.
Well, I'm here, so I'll start in the interest of efficiency. I'm Ed Lichtenstein. I'm a senior scientist at Oregon Research Institute in Eugene and a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Oregon, and I'm here to speak in support of the tobacco control program, TPEP, and I spoke to you several weeks ago, so this is also a coda to that. I will try to highlight my points of my written testimony, which I will leave with you. Tobacco is the leading cause of preventable death in Oregon. Oregon physician data indicated that 6,700 Oregonians died of tobacco-related causes in 2001. 50,000 Oregon youth now smoke, and we can reliably expect that fully a third of them will eventually die prematurely of tobacco-related disease. A comprehensive program can avert much of this disaster, and the Centers for Disease Control has outlined the nature of such a program, and Oregon has one. This program has been implemented by DHS. This is a voter-mandated program, as has been pointed out to you, and the program is working. The program is evaluated by the Health Division, and that evaluation is overseen by a technical advisory committee of both local and outside national experts. I am one of the several volunteers on that committee and now chair it. The evaluation has, since 1966, looked carefully at both survey data, objective survey data, and consumption data, and has tracked changes over time. The data clearly show that both adult consumption and adult prevalence and youth consumption and youth prevalence have decreased significantly, that these increases in Oregon are well beyond what we'd expect from any national or secular trend, and that the these changes or reductions are attributable to the effectiveness of the program. So you have a voter-mandated program that is demonstrably effective, that is accountable, and monitors its ongoing effectiveness.
Thank you, Dr. Lechtenstein.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Labby. I'm medical director of CARE Oregon and one of the co-chairs of Project Prevention, which is the task force of the Oregon Health Plan contractors that deals with quality improvement statewide. I want to talk in support of the Tobacco Prevention Education Program, and I want to focus particularly on what Project Prevention has done because I know time is limited. I have given you separately a orange-colored sheet that does have a lot of the issues that are just been referred to in terms of smoking-related diseases. And I want to highlight particularly the fact at the top that it says that we are going to pay for the smoking-related diseases unless we prevent them. There was a CDC study done in the mid-90s published by in the NMWR that said that 43% of all smoking-related medical care expenditures are going to be covered by the state or federal government. So we are going to pay for this. We also know that in among the Oregon Health Plan population in adults, that 41% are smokers, and that's almost double the general population. So we felt in Project Prevention from the beginning that it was very important to have a program that addressed this issue. We started very simply a number of years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, trying to get providers when they see patients to ask about smoking. There's a, you may have heard about the five A's. There's, you know, ask, advise, assess, assist, and arrange. We have really made progress statewide in getting physicians to ask about smoking at every visit. The same way they do a blood pressure, a weight, they check the heart rate, they ask about smoking. Where we are now in Project Prevention is we were prepared in the fall to launch a statewide campaign, basically moving people to ask about help for smoking when they see their provider, and the cornerstone of that was referral to the Oregon Quit Line. This is the handout that we had prepared, hundreds of thousands of these. These were going to go out in every mailing that the health plan sent out. We were going to send them out, had OMAP send them out, as we were direct people to get help, because we are now at the point where
we can
give help, and we need to be able to do that. So I hope you will support this program in the future.
Ms. Mueller?
It's Miller. I'm Patty Miller from...
You didn't dot your I, okay.
Oh, sorry. I'm speaking today for tobacco as well as a health educator from Paloma School District's Tobacco Prevention and Program. I worked with them for 5 years and have been involved in prevention for the last 14. I've seen prevention change over a time period where we used to just put posters on the wall and call that prevention. We used to take kids to leadership camps and call that prevention. But what the Tobacco Prevention Program for school-based programs has done in Oregon is taken a comprehensive approach that has been very successful. I can speak from Philomath's standpoint in that we've seen a 64% reduction among 8th grade smoking. We've seen a 69% reduction in chewing in 8th grade. We've seen a 47% reduction in 11th grade smoking and 50% chewing reduction in 11th grade as well over that four-year time period. The program is cost-effective. It's comprehensive. It focuses on policy, on community linkages, on working with parents and adults. We use the quit line. If we didn't have the quit line to refer, we'd have to use very costly treatment approaches. I have a student that came into my office a couple of weeks ago before my job ended and showed me a spot on her tongue. She's been chewing since she was 10 years old. She's 14 now. It's been 2 years of heavy chew use, and she's got a spot on her tongue that looks cancerous to me, and I had to tell her, you need to go in. I'm not sure what's going to happen with her. I don't know if she lives in that denial period, but addiction and treatment are spendy, but prevention, you can see.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, clarification from Dr. Labby. Did you say we are still going to use this?
That's going to be decided at the project prevention meeting next Monday. They are all printed and waiting to be sent out.
Is this the quit line?
That is the quit line.
Which will no longer exist.
That's right. So we don't know what we're going to do with
it. How much would these cost?
I don't have the figure. It was printed by OMAP.
Could you get that to us?
Yes, we can.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Lucy Longoria and Laurie Ann Sheridan and Idella Mims.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, my name is Lucy Longoria, and I live at 115 Southeast 73rd Avenue in Portland, Oregon. I was born and raised out in Malheur County. I went to school down at the University of Oregon, and I've been working in Portland for the last 10 years. I'm here representing Upstream Public Health, a group of volunteers dedicated to solving public health problems at the source. I'm here to urge the funding of the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program. With over 400,000 of their customers either dying or quitting, it is critical for the tobacco.
If you're reading the text and you hand it to us, summarize it for us so that others can be able to speak.
I certainly will. It's critical for the tobacco industry to recruit new smokers. So how do they do this? Tobacco corporations pour money into Oregon. They spend dollars to promote the only product on the market that kills when used exactly as directed. It's estimated the tobacco industry spends over $117 million in marketing here in Oregon each year, about 15 times the annual TPEP budget. Let's not forget that this industry also spends dollars right here in my home state to guarantee politically their unlimited access to our young people, to our poor, and to our ethnic minorities. I'm here today to describe how tobacco disproportionately affects certain segments of the population. While overall 21% of Oregon adults are smokers, Oregon's American Indian adult population experiences a tobacco use rate of 44%. 27% of African-American adults use tobacco. 36% of people with low socioeconomic status use tobacco. And it's estimated that up to 50% of the lesbian gay population smokes. It's quite obvious that the tobacco industry is fully aware of the potential these minorities offer as profitable markets. Their marketing strategies and tactics aggressively target these groups, all part of their never-ending mission to maximize profits at our cost. Oregon's TPEP program, despite severely limited resources compared to those of the industry, was achieving success in addressing tobacco use and its terrible toll in Oregon. Much work was accomplished and many partnerships were built in order to effectively and appropriately address tobacco use among these different populations. Without the program, this terrible killer will go unchecked. I participated in a statewide work group to determine how to tackle these disparities.
Thank you.
But because of our current cut of TPEP, we lost the opportunity to access an additional $25,000 federal grant to continue this work.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Idella Mims, and I'm in the Alberta Simmons apartment. And I'm here for the Oregon Action. Please don't cut the Oregon Action because it's a program that does the senior citizen real well. And also, the cost of I have worked on one job for 27 years, and the cost of my medicine, three bottles of medicine, one bottle is $110 a bottle, very small bottle, and another one is much smaller than that, is $79, another one is $56. And with my retirement, and if medicine go up, How can I make it? Please help us all senior citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mann. Lori Ann.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lori Ann Sheridan with the Oregon Health Action Campaign, and I thank you for this opportunity to provide public input. I do have handouts, so I will not address it all. We have included a number of recommended solutions that might help you in your deliberations. I would ask that the committee agree to an additional hearing on the Oregon Health Plan when all the policy changes being discussed at the various committee levels are finalized and presented to you. Given the already vast expenditures on health care, it seems quite contradictory that increased and dedicated revenues are the solution to the Oregon Health Plan. But until OHP is folded into and made a seamless part of the health delivery system and financing whole, increased revenues are precisely what is necessary for this component of Oregon's health system, health care system, which involves revenues to hold on to essential medical and mental health services and medications for existing OHP and medically needy enrollees, revenues to increase reimbursement rates for and capacity of the primary care provider vital to the success and prevention-oriented Oregon Health Plan, and revenues to expand coverage and ultimately lower OHP per capita costs. Hopefully our written testimony will help clarify a lot more of what we had to share with you. Thank you very much.
Lori. Melinda Mowry, Marcia Kelly, and on deck is Adrian Daniels and Jessica Stevens.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, my name is Melinda Mowry. I am the mental health director.
How are you, Melinda?
Fine, thank you. Mental health director for Clackamas County and also the director of the MHO in Clackamas County. I've been listening to the tapes of the budget hearings, and I thought that I might be able to make some points that would be helpful. That might be presumptive, but I'm going to try. I thought it might be helpful to talk a little bit about how some of the systems are managing now, and I'm speaking for Clackamas. I'm not speaking for all counties. Clackamas County lost, when we lost the Oregon Health Plan benefit, we had 500 people in service. We had a treatment commitment to those people, and we have made every effort to try to use a blend of service redesign and carryover funds to try to provide a stopgap when I have, and to create touch points for people in the system so that people may not be able to get the same level of system, but there still is some place for people to receive some connection to the possibility of help. What I want to talk about is how I build our budget for this year, because I know there have been questions about MHO reserves and how much carryover is in the counties. What I did is to try to look at what our budget would look like, presuming that mental health Medicaid services remain for the categorical eligible. So my budget is built on that assumption. I took all of the carryover that I had, and I've always tried to keep 10%. I know there's been a conversation about how many months, but our standard has been 10% of our operating budget. I tried to divide that out over 3 years, and I really could not stomach it, and I have now projected out about 2 years in which we could try to manage the system with the level of cuts that we have. And again, that just presumes that Medicaid mental health continues. I think if mental health Medicaid services are discontinued, then I think we have to really relook at everything that we've tried to do so far. Yesterday, the Clackamas County Board of County Commissioners met, and we are going to begin restricting the front door. We've been trying to hold services for people for whom we had that treatment commitment. What I want to try to emphasize is that as we try to do the redesign, I think Angela Kimball's testimony from last week was very important in terms of needing to remember that what the service recipients need, not what the agencies and the providers need, and how do we have systems of care. I like to try to think of a crisis time as a catalyst for change. I think there are changes that we can make. I think there's been some compelling testimony before the audit committee that is worthy of consideration. My concern is that if we lose too much, we lose that opportunity for the necessary changes in the system. Thank you.
Thank you. Marcia.
Chair Winters and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition. Our members include the American Association of University Women of Oregon, Delta Kappa Gamma, the Oregon National Organization for Women, the Salem YWCA, here's my dollar for Rosie, the Oregon Women's Political Caucus, and Oregon's Older Women's League. It's almost impossible to testify on the budget for the health clusters for the Department of Human Resources, and I would second the request for when you get funding organized for the Oregon Health Plan to have additional public testimony. Prevention, detection, and treatment are all very, very important. The women that I represent have problems with addiction, smoke, have kids who are needy of services, have need for lots of services, but there are also people in there who are providing volunteer work. One of the things that I've done is I've left you a piece of written testimony from the American Association of University Women talking about one of the things that might help, and that's resources. But some of the things that are discussed in here are concerns that we really have. One of the last priorities that I saw listed from yesterday's presentation was women who have no insurance coverage who are diagnosed with cervical and breast cancer. It's not a matter of what's going to happen if they don't get treatment, we all know. And that's the bottom of the list. The top of the list is prevention. Those things are very hard to prevent. I'm a former staff member for the American Cancer Society. So when you're looking at your priorities, think about the bottom priority that's going to get left off unless you look for more resources.
Adrian, Jesse.
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
I see there are friends from my district that still
like
may be yet
to testify.
But I need to apologize because I have a hearing at 3 o'clock that I'm scheduled to present a bill. So I do want to apologize to my constituents for having to leave. Their testimony is important.
Move everything along.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'll ask the questions for you.
Okay. Thank you.
I accept you to go. You know our opinion.
I've heard them, yes.
He takes good care of you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Winters and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Stevens, and I'm with SEIU Local 503, the Oregon Public Employees Union. I'm just going to let Adrian present the rest of our testimony.
Thank you. Welcome, Adrian.
My name is Adrian Daniel. I'm a eligibility worker with the Oregon Health Plan. I've worked there since the fall of 1999. I know you have some concerns and some questions about eligibility and how we're processing. So I wanted to give you a few points regarding what impacts our workload. Since January of this year, of course, everyone knows there have been many changes. One of the changes that impacts us doing our daily routine is a new addendum to the Oregon Health Plan. It's a green sheet, and it goes out with each and every application now. This is a requirement of the application. It requires signatures. For some reason, it doesn't come back to us. We then have to write a letter, send this back to the applicant with a letter, a handwritten letter, asking them to please sign it and return it. Some of the other issues that are occurring right now are the issue of arrears. This is new to many people because they've not had to be paying arrears necessarily in the past. Now we are required to pend for those arrears, and we have a list. Either we put the application aside, send another letter telling them they have to pay their arrears before we can approve their application, or set the or go ahead and process the application and have a list for denial at the time that their 45 days is up. At work, because of the new policy changes and procedure changes, every day at work there's a new procedure, a new policy. Errors are made, confusion, and so this also impacts our workload. We get increased numbers of phone calls from clients now because they are misunderstanding the PIN notices for the addendums, for the arrears, and so we do have an increase of phone calls from clients. Regarding the
Do you have that in writing? Do you have your testimony in writing?
No, I don't.
You don't?
We'll provide that
for me?
Yeah, be glad to.
Okay. Because we are interested in what happens, and we did have yesterday before our committee someone talking about eligibility, and we walked through some of the applications yesterday. So if you could provide that in writing to me, it would be much appreciated.
I'll be happy to.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Diane Lafter and Anita Thompson and Judy Wilson. And Diane, I know that you wanted to show a movie. We will not have the time to do that. I'm sorry, but we're pushing behind schedule. I know how long it is, but we will not have the time to do it.
I gave up my 2 minutes, remember?
I give you credit.
Now you're going to take it away. Yeah, it's from a woman who's picked a comment just by
herself. I just made a decision.
Okay.
And but I will hear all those who are here, Anita Thompson, Judy Wilson. We've got a whole list of people who still want to testify, and we can have you come back again before we finish the committee. But I need to talk to people who came and wanted to be heard. Okay? So,
yes, Madam Chair,
yeah.
If that's a video,
we can you can give it to us so we can show it.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. But I would like to have Anita Thompson. If she's here. If she's not here, Judy Wilson, is she here? Will Crawford? Judy already testified. They were on two pages. Will Crawford and Dan Ober, Frankie Williams. If they're not here, you can show your film.
Really? Okay, wonderful. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity. My name is Diane Lauder, and I'm the Tobacco Advocacy Manager for the American Lung Association of Oregon. I know you've heard from the Lung Association before. We represent about 300,000 donors, volunteers, and participants in our program who are steadfast supporters of the Tobacco Prevention Education Program. Today I wanted to show you the testimony of a woman who is too sick to come. Thank you for...
Show the film.
Thank you. Thank you. So we went to sleep here.
Yes, tell the film. While she's getting set, how long is it going to take you to set up?
You know what? Well, maybe somebody else.
Well, they can go ahead and talk while she's trying to set up. Dan? Is it Dan?
Will.
Will, would you go ahead?
Yes, thank you for allowing us to be here today. My name is Will Crawford, and I live in Albany, and I don't represent anybody but myself and a few hundred thousand other voters. I'm here because I think it's critical that funding for the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program be kept intact. For over 60 years, I've suffered from asthma, which is a direct result of tobacco smoking by my father when I was a child, and he died as a result of that smoking. I don't blame him for that because he didn't know about it, but there is knowledge now about the dire effects of tobacco use. The voters of this state have mandated that 3 cents, only 3 cents, from the sale on each pack of cigarettes be used for educating people about these hazards. This program has proven to save lives and money. This is not general fund money. And nowhere in this tax law is permission given to the legislature to use this 3 cents to cover shortfalls in the general fund. Please respect this mandate that you have been given by the people of this state. I urge you to preserve funding for this life and money-saving effort, the Tobacco Prevention and Education Program for the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Is that Anita Thompson right next to you? Is that Ms. Thompson?
Frankie Williams.
Oh, Frankie Williams? Okay. Why don't you go ahead and then I'll just let her wrap it up with her filming.
Me?
Mm-hmm.
I'm Frankie Williams, Madam Winner's Chair and the committee. And I'm extremely nervous. I've always been terrified about talking in front of people, but this is extremely important to me. I am a consumer of mental health services. I have 29 years of sobriety from alcohol and drug addiction.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Pardon?
Congratulations.
Thank you. I was born into a family of alcoholism, drug addiction, and mental illness, so I could, and heavy smokers. I could testify for everybody that's testified up here today. I have 6 years of non-smoking. My mental health medication helped me to quit smoking. I have went to Yamhill County Mental Health. I was put into a vocational rehabilitation program. I was able to recover successfully and get a job with the county. I was hired to help other consumers. I also founded a drop-in center for the mentally ill. However, last September I had to retire due to the fact that my daughter, who had 5 years of recovery, went back to methamphetamine and tried to get into treatment but was told to come back in 2 weeks for an assessment. And she didn't make it to the assessment. And now she's facing prison or jail, and her husband's going, but that doesn't bother me at all. These children, I have had to quit work and take care of. Her husband has never been in recovery and doesn't want to. Anyhow, enough of that. I wouldn't be here today. I've had urges to kill myself since I was a little girl because I've lived through hell as a child of an alcoholic and a drug addict. I woke up one night hearing my father growl in the hall. I thought there was an animal in the house, and I was terrified until I found out it was my dad, but then I was still terrified. I turned my own mother in when I was 16 and got myself put in a foster home. She was my provider, my mother. I left the nurse foster home because she said she'd let me get married. I married an abusive man. We both drank together. And it wasn't until I got treatment from supported employment I was able to leave that abusive situation. I have been self-supporting through my own contributions up until last September. I am now 62, 63, I don't know.
Ms. Williams, we really want to thank you because it's your testimony that puts a real face. You know, we hear often from those who come who are either the providers or the lobbyists and what have you, and it's very, we really appreciate it when the individuals who actually are going through the system and who can tell us the experience, and I was told it was 2 minutes, but I just want to thank you because it takes a lot of courage for you to come here and to share with us your life. And I think I speak for the members up here, and you did quite well. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I'm going to hear Dan, and then I'm going to wrap up with your video.
Okay, Chair Winters and members of the board, I'm glad you like firsthand accounts because I'm going to give you another one.
For the record, this is Dan Ober, right?
Yeah, this is Dan Ober. Yeah, okay. I was back in around 1992 diagnosed with mental illness, and I was pretty much paralyzed with anxiety and obsessive thoughts. And then I was went and saw a doctor, and he put me on medication, and that was a godsend. It really helped me out, and I can't express enough how important meds are. And then moved down to, I forgot to mention I live in McMinnville, but I moved down to McMinnville and found a psychosocial vocational rehabilitation center called Abacus. And there, for the first time in a long time, I thought I fit in with these people that were there. And I learned socialization and living skills, and I was able to move out of my parents' house into my own apartment, and also was able to get a job. I co-founded the same drop-in center that Frankie was talking about, and that is very important to my life and other people's life. It's a good place to go. It's safe, and everybody there encourages everybody, and even though I am on meds and I'm getting support from, or even though I'm on meds, I still need other support. Like I see a counselor every few weeks, and again, I want to express that meds are very important, and so I'd like to have funding going towards meds and the abacus type programs, you know, that help the psychosocial vocational programs and stuff. I guess that's it.
Thank you. And I think we do know that meds are very important.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Ready?
You ready?
My name is Fran Atwood. I live here in Portland at the Hearthstone. I live in Beaverton, Oregon. I am, frankly, dying of emphysema. How much longer I have to go, I don't know, but my time is really quite short now. I have smoked for 40 years, and I know that the smoking is responsible for almost all my problems, health problems. Lungs do not reinvent themselves, even with modern medicine. What is left of the rest of my life will be always restricted, always medicated. No more flying around the dance floor. No more racing up the steps. No more picking up grandchildren and swinging them through the air. These are the days of the treadmill under a nurse's supervision. These are the days of the measured steps. These are the days of remembering when breathing was something I did unconsciously. Life was full of running and chasing children and having so much energy I could hardly use it up. I'm now an observer delegated to the sidelines, watching the world go by. If the wages of sin is death, then the wages of smoking is your life controlled by staggeringly expensive medicine. In the corner of my bedroom stands an unsightly 4-foot-tall oxygen cylinder with 50 feet of plastic tubing attached so I can move around the house like a dog on a leash. Stacked in the closet are also 3 small cylinders that give me freedom to leave the house. Mornings start with carefully counted medicine, 10 varieties in all, many of them necessary to counteract the drugs I take and inhale. It takes 4 varieties of inhalers used throughout the day in varying doses to keep my bronchial tubes open so oxygen can pass through them to my compromised lungs. I function like a marionette. Take my medicine. Count the puffs on each inhaler, especially the one that costs $104 for a 1-month supply. Make sure the oxygen tank is filled. My life is automated by routine. My brother, Howard Woodford Harrington, 1916-66, smoker of Camels, died of throat cancer. My sister, Louise Harrington Harding, 1917-1954, smoker of Lucky Strikes, died in a cigarette-induced clothing fire. Her little girls tried to put the blaze out by throwing cups of water at her. Francis Harrington Coe Atwood, 1925, smoker of Chesterfields, struggling with emphysema. I cannot be here with you to talk to you in person, but I'm asking the Oregon legislature to restore the funding to the Tobacco Prevention Education Fund. Without the support, there's really nothing available for the smokers to have to prevent the youth from starting to smoke. There will be many more Oregonians like me that will be sort of in the water without a paddle. I hope you will do this for people like me. I hope you will give some credence to how necessary it is to keep these youngsters from smoking. I feel that's of prime importance. Again, how long I'll be here, I don't know. But I wish you all luck. Godspeed. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Members, tomorrow we will be wrapping up the Health Services Commission. They will be back to bring us additional data and information that we had requested throughout these hearings before we move to next week into some of the other hearings. And so with that, we are adjourned. Thank you for your patience.